Samuel, maybe you're asking yourself the question, well, that's great, but what about 1 Samuel? Can we not do 1 Samuel first and then do 2 Samuel? Well, we are going to do 1 Samuel first. We're going to run through it now in about 15 minutes, so let's do it. Chronologically, 1 and 2 Samuel, it's coming. Chronologically, 1 and 2 Samuel comes after Judges and that whole period of redemptive history. It's a sad period of history for God's people. You read of them repeatedly drifting away from God, going further and further away from God's word, and therefore having very, very little evident distinction between them and the world around them. And so you read of God providing for them again and again a judge like Gideon, Deborah even, Samson. But judges that the Lord raised up in order to bring his people back to himself, in the hope of seeing them come to their senses, come back to him again with a whole heart, with a determined will. And the repeated pattern throughout the book of Judges is that as long as the judge lived, then the people were kept in order. Sadly, though, as soon as the judge died, things went back to normal again. The people rebelled against God, and certainly when you read those closing chapters of the book of Judges, they get up to some crazy things. They have drifted so far away from God's word. The book of Judges concludes with those well-known words, chapter 21, 25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. Or as the New Living Translation puts it, all the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. Doesn't that sound like today? In our days, people don't fear God anymore. And therefore, the people do whatever seems right in their own eyes. So, Judges concludes by showing us the people need a special judge of sorts. Someone who will faithfully lead them in righteousness. Someone who will govern them according to God's word. When you then come into 1 Samuel, we discover that the Levitical priesthood, the people who should be encouraging God's people to be faithful, godly, they're spiritually poor and corrupt and in need of replacement. And hence we come to the birth of Samuel. Samuel is God's man. Samuel is the one who will replace Eli and his ungodly priestly sons. Chapter 3, verse 19, the Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and he let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba recognized that Samuel was attested as a prophet of the Lord. The Lord continued to appear at Shiloh, and there he revealed himself to Samuel through his word. So Israel has a new priest, a godly priest, a faithful priest. Israel now has a recognized prophet. Why would they want anything more? But they do. They now ask for a king. Chapter 8, verse 5, you are old, Samuel, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. And so Samuel explains the consequences of their request, what a king will mean for them in having to support a king. He warns them about wanting a king rather than trusting the Lord their God as their king. But they respond, chapter 8, verse 19, no, we want a king over us. Then we shall be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles. And so we come to Saul. Saul in chapter 9. Saul, the kind of king the Israelites instinctively would have wanted. Chapter 10, verse 23, as Saul stood among the people, he was a head taller than any of the others. Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people." In other words, it's what Saul looks like that seems to matter to even Samuel and the people. It's not how godly Saul is, but how gorgeous Saul is. And sadly, it's not long before we see the quality of Saul's heart. In chapter 13, he offers a sacrifice which he shouldn't have offered. Samuel had told him to wait for him a week, I think it was. He was to wait until Samuel arrived, and then Samuel would offer up the sacrifice, which he only could as a priest. The problem was, though, Saul was fighting the Philistine army, and his men were leaving him. And so he took it upon himself. He judged himself worthy enough to offer the sacrifice. He failed. In chapter 15, Saul doesn't deal with the Amalekites as he was told to. God had told him through Samuel to go and to attack the Amalekites and to wipe them off the face of the earth, to kill all of them, every one of them, to destroy all their livestock, destroy all their property, have nothing to do with the Amalekites whatsoever. The problem was, though, Saul thought he knew better than God. And so he didn't kill all the Amalekites. He kept the best of all the Amalekites for himself. So the Lord finally rejects Saul as king of his people. Chapter 15, verse 22, Samuel tells him, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord?" To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, an arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. It's interesting how Saul's rejection of God's word is described here through disobedience, through rebellion, through arrogance. And again, you could apply that to things like today. So this kind of king, King Saul, the kind of king that the people were naturally drawn to, fails. We haven't time to go into that in more detail. But that kind of king having failed then leads us into another kind of king in chapter 16, where the story of David begins. David, the youngest of Jesse's sons. David, seemingly so insignificant, even to his dad, that his dad didn't bother to call him in from looking after the sheep when Samuel called on their house asking to see all his sons. And you have that wonderful scene where each of Jesse's sons come before Samuel, and there they all seem so tall, so strong, so handsome. Surely one of them must be the new king. Chapter 16, verse 6, when they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." So David is now described as a man after the Lord's own heart. He's a different kind of leader. So David is anointed by Samuel. In the next chapter, you see David proving his credentials, proving his heart, the quality of his heart when he goes out to face Goliath. And so with a strong, a steady faith in God, with only a sling, with only five smooth stones, he goes out to face this giant, Goliath. Chapter 17, verse 45, "You come against me, Goliath, with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. And you know the rest of the story. It's here that David's friendship with Jonathan begins. Jonathan, who was next in line to the throne, to Jonathan, son of Saul, king of Israel. But after David's bold fight with Goliath, chapter 18, verse 1, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. We'll go back there again tonight. So David's fame now rises significantly. And this causes Saul to become jealous. As they're returning home from the battle, they hear the woman singing their victory songs. Chapter 18, verse 7. Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And so Saul now begins his relentless jealousy towards David, which is made worse with some form of mental disturbance Saul has. We haven't time to explore this further, but we're told the source of Saul's poor mental health is an evil spirit. Chapter 16, verse 14. Now the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. And so now Saul will regularly slip into fits of paranoia. At times he'll slip into even fits of blind rage. Twice, when David is playing his harp to try and calm Saul down, Saul throws his spear at David, trying to kill him. So after the second time, David decides, I better leave. He flees for his life. And Saul now begins his pursuit of David, chasing him all over Israel, following up on rumors he's heard along the line of where David's now hiding, sending his army out after David, desperate to try and catch this threat to his throne and put him to death. So twice Saul tries to kill David, but then twice David spares Saul's life. And the first time in chapter 24 in the cave, when Saul is at the toilet, so to speak. In chapter 26, during the night, when Saul is asleep and he's surrounded by his army, David creeps in to the very center of the camp and takes a jug of water and a spear by Saul's head. At least two times, David could have killed Saul. He could have taken things into his own hands and taken the throne for himself, but he wouldn't. He couldn't. Chapter 24, verse 10. This day you have seen with your own eyes, Saul, how the Lord gave you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not lift my hand against my master, because he is the Lord's anointed. So David is driven out of his homeland, driven away from being able to worship the Lord at his temple at Shiloh. And now he lives among the Philistines at a village called Ziklag. From Ziklag he leads raiding parties into Philistine villages, plundering their goods. Only on one occasion, when he's out plundering, the Amalekites come and plunder Ziklag. And so he has to go after them to get back his wife and his wives and his family. Meanwhile, for Saul, the Philistines have come out again to fight against Israel. At this particular fight, their army is huge. And when Saul goes out to fight against him on Mount Gilboa, he's terrified. Chapter 28, verse 5. Terror filled his heart. But you see, the Lord had left Saul now. So when Saul tries to ask for help, there's no answer. Samuel also has now died, so Saul is now very much on his own. So what does he do? He turns to a witch for help, the witch of Endor in chapter 30. I think this is probably the lowest point in Saul's life. It really affirms the beginning of the end for him. Because rather than genuinely humbling himself before God, what Saul does is show his heart again. And he goes to a witch. He goes to this woman and asks her to be a medium for him. He wants the witch to raise up Samuel from the dead so he can speak to Samuel and get advice from him as to what he's now to do with this huge army that's in front of him. Chapter 28, verse 15, Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" "I am in great distress," Saul said. "The Philistines are fighting against me, and God has turned away from me. He no longer answers me either by prophets or by dreams. So I have called on you to tell me what to do." Samuel said, "Why do you consult me now that the Lord has turned away from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done what he predicted through me. The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hands and given it to one of your neighbors, to David. Because you did not obey the Lord or carry out his fierce wrath against the Amalekites, the Lord has done this to you today. The Lord will hand both Israel and you to the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also hand over the army of Israel to the Philistines." So that's an overview of 1 Samuel. We've highlighted just certain key events that will help us as we move into 2 Samuel, as we begin that study tonight. But before we do that, let's just conclude 1 Samuel by reading of the death